Welcome to the F3, Female Forward Finance. I'm your host, Jill Faraday Lloyd, a financial advisor at UBS Private Wealth, and I'm on a mission to help women have agency with their capital. The F3 is a space for real conversations about money, power, and everything in between. You'll hear from experts, entrepreneurs, and everyday Janes about the choices they're making when it comes to their wealth. These are critical conversations because women are earning, building, and shaping what comes next in the world, and it's time we own every bit of our power. In this week's F3 podcast, I sit down with Carrie Larson, Executive Director and Senior Wealth Strategist at UBS in their Advanced Planning Group. We discuss why founders should start planning their personal wealth 12 to 24 months before a sale of their business. We explore the strategies that can help preserve more of what they've built and why many of those opportunities become limited once a letter of intent is signed. Many business owners focus on maximizing enterprise value, but some of the most significant wealth planning opportunities occur well before the letter of intent is signed. Carrie shares why planning in advance can help founders preserve more wealth, create tax efficiencies, transfer wealth to future generations, and align their financial success with their long-term legacy goals. We discuss the importance of valuation planning, cash flow analysis, estate planning strategies, QSBS opportunities, charitable giving, and why building the right advisory team early makes all the difference. The key takeaways today is the most successful exits aren't just about what you sell your business for. They're about how much of that value you keep, protect, and pass on. So I'm excited to introduce you to Carrie Larson, Executive Director and Senior Wealth Strategist. Carrie works with ultra-high net worth clients of UBS and their advisors on issues involving estate and tax planning, business succession, wealth transfer, and philanthropic objectives. She focuses on developing and implementing comprehensive wealth transfer strategies to assist clients with their complex planning needs, such as preservation, transfer, and management of wealth. Carrie also reviews clients' estate planning documents to ensure that each plan accurately reflects the family's legacy goals and objectives while leveraging available tax-efficient planning strategies. Carrie worked at Goldman as a financial planner prior to this in the Goldman Sachs family office. She has her JD from New York Law School, and she holds her certified financial planner designation. Carrie Larson, welcome to the F3.
Thank you.
So glad to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
I really wanted to talk about this timeline that I keep referring to, which is the 12 to 24 months before an LOI is signed. Really, how early in your experience should business owners begin planning for an exit? And why is that timing so important?
Yeah, it's a great question. And the answer typically is always the earlier the better. Mentioning that 12 to 24 months really is that sweet spot, especially before a sale, but even before a letter of intent is received prior or when contemplating selling a business.
So, Carrie, we talk about this 12 to 24 month pre-letter of intent as a line in the sand.
Yeah.
Why is that so important? When should business owners who are preparing for an exit really start to think about that planning? And why is that timeline so important?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, generally speaking, the earlier the better, right? That LOI, as you said, is that line in the sand as it affects the valuation of the business for gift tax purposes, which in turn can affect a lot of the decisions that the client can choose from when looking at their legacy plan and tax transfer planning. So having that window really fosters intentional and thoughtful planning for the business owner versus reacting under pressure in a time constraint. So that window is long enough where that business owner or grantor, giver, patriarch, or matriarch can look at their basic estate plan, make sure that the fundamentals are in place, and then select from a broader range of tax and estate planning strategies that may not otherwise be available to them closer to the sale or the exit of their business. So this really maximizes both the flexibility and control over their legacy plan.
So hopefully, Carrie, I'm going to just make a comment. Hopefully, the seller of the business is getting a high valuation.
That's right. Right.
Once that letter of intent is signed.
Yeah. So typically speaking, when businesses are being appraised and there is no letter of intent on the table or a third party purchaser who's saying they'll purchase the business for X amount, typically a lower valuation is obtained from that business.
So that lower valuation is important in estate planning. Let's talk a little bit about why that is and how that can be helpful in maximizing value.
So as we mentioned, that business tends to be valued on more traditional valuation practices and not what someone is willing to pay for it in mm-hmm. that transaction. So when we look at gifting interests in that business, it's better to obtain obviously a lower valuation because you're able to use more of your lifetime gift and estate tax exemption amount when gifting those assets.
So what are the lifetime exemption amounts?
Great question. So under current law, each individual is able to gift $15 million before a federal transfer tax is applied, and that transfer tax is 40%. So what that means is that they can either gift assets during life and or through their estate when they pass, assuming they pass under the current law that's in place. So for instance, I could give you $5 million tomorrow, and then if I were to pass away next month, I would have my remaining $10 million to shield assets within my estate from that 40% tax at the federal
level. But everything
level.
Above that total of $15 million is getting taxed at 40%.
That's right.
That's on the federal level.
That's
and
on the federal.
On
depending
the
on your
level.
State.
So,
yep.
For example, in New York,
does not have a gift tax. So you can essentially gift any amount during your lifetime without a New York estate tax, as it's only an estate tax, as mentioned. But any gifts within 3 years of death would count towards that exemption, which currently is $7.35 million per person. Anything above that, the highest rate is 16%, but there's also a nasty New York cliff. So if your estate is 105% over $7.35 million, they'll tax you from dollar one. Whereas federal is not the same.
So if you are a founder who is selling their business and they think that they're going to give their kids $50 million, so their heirs will get $50 million, mm-hmm. they really only get 15 and the remaining will be taxed at 40% federal and some state
yeah.
level.
Yeah.
So that's the key element here.
Right.
That's why I wanted to have you on this conversation
yes.
because
yes.
you think that you're maximizing the value of your business. That's great. Let's get as much as you can on an enterprise value for your business.
For sure.
But what are the steps that you should be thinking about as a human, as a parent, or as a creating multi-generational wealth so that's as efficient as possible? So
yeah, that's a great question. So when contemplating your legacy plan, there really is no wrong answer. I've had clients say, I want to push as much wealth to my descendants as possible without paying tax or little as tax as possible. Some say, I'd like my descendants to receive X and the rest of it can be donated. And then I've had clients on the whole other end of the spectrum say, I don't care, I'm dead. I don't care if they tax it. I don't care if my descendants get it outright. Who cares? I'm dead. Can't control it from the grave. So there's no wrong answer in any of those responses. So it's really up to the client to think about how they want their legacy to look like. Is it providing for future generations? Is it philanthropy? Is it tax avoidance? Is it
I want to pay taxes?
Yeah.
I'm working with
yes.
a client right now who came from a communist country or socialist country. Sorry, yeah. Not a communist, a socialist country. And she's like, I believe in taxes.
Yes,
I
mean, sure.
I have to say that's a rare community.
Yes.
But so if we want to have a valuation done, so we're going to sell your business in 12 to 24 months. And
yep.
We know that somebody's going to be willing to pay you X dollars.
Yep.
And we're saying you want to start doing the work. So let's go through that valuation process. What does it look like for a private business owner?
It's a great question. So while investment banks or outside companies may come in to value the business, say ahead of a sale or annual financial reporting, a qualified appraisal is usually necessary when valuing business interests that are going to be gifted or donated. So depending on when the company was last valued and the methods used, a qualified appraiser may be able to incorporate that valuation into their own analysis. However, generally speaking, they're trying to determine two values. One, the value of the company on its face, and two, the value of the company for gift tax purposes. So while a qualified appraiser can often charge around $50,000 or so, it's really crucial that one is obtained when contemplating gifting business interests.
Okay, I love that because sometimes founders might balk at that
yes.
$50,000 number. Let's talk about the advantages within the valuations, right? The goal here is to have a valuation that is as low as possible
Correct.
On the business.
That's right.
At that particular time,
yes.
because you want to move those assets off your balance sheet and onto somebody else's balance sheet, because we know, because we just said we have this $15 million limit
yeah.
that we can pass along. So what are some of the valuation of advantages
yeah.
that a founder is looking for?
Yeah, that's a great point. So you mentioned, one, getting that valuation as low as possible. So getting that qualified appraisal early on in the process assumedly is going to yield a lower valuation, which means, as you mentioned, transferring more of the business interest using less of the exemption available to you, that $15 million lifetime exemption. So in addition to valuing that business at a lower value, qualified appraisers also take into account any valuation discounts that might be available, including for lack of control or transferring of a minority interest and for lack of marketability as the business is closely held. So depending on specific circumstances, these valuation discounts can often range between 15 and 30%, which is a huge win.
Okay, so let's say ultimately you get a $100 million value at LOI 2 years before the value of the business is worth significantly less than what somebody's willing to pay you. And you also get the discounts for lack of marketability and lack of control.
That's right. That's right. So while $50,000 or so could seem like a large upfront cost to acquire this qualified appraisal, it ends up yielding potentially millions in benefit.
You and I were talking about somebody who balked at this.
Yeah.
Tell me the story.
Yeah. It was a situation where a client was contemplating making gifts to the family business, of the family business to a trust for the family members. And the matriarch initially balked at the cost and said, that's really expensive. Can't I just use the old business valuation we did 6 months ago? Why do I have to pay this fee? And I get it, totally understandable. That seems like a large upfront cost. But we were able to model out a few planning strategies and scenarios showing her the actual difference between making gifts of the business to trust now with that valuation discount versus waiting until a sale occurs or the business is appraised at a higher valuation. And she was really able to see in black and white that potentially millions could be saved. The great part of this story is that when discussing this with her company, she also found another owner who was going to go in with it on her, was looking to do planning themselves. So they were able to actually split the cost of the appraisal, which helped soften the blow.
Message to co-founders.
Yes, exactly.
Do it together. Economies
exactly.
of scale. That's wonderful. So the analysis really helped inform the entire estate planning process, I presume, for
exactly.
that woman.
And exactly.
make sure it ensured that she didn't have to overpay. Her heirs weren't overpaying. They yeah. weren't having to pay taxes. I love that.
And I think even looking to save all of those discounts or to make that transfer at a lower valuation, I guess the point is that it's required. The IRS requires a qualified appraisal for non-marketable business interests that are gifted to trusts or beneficiaries. So it's required if you're looking to do it. Now, if you do it ahead of that LOI, you're able to do it with a lower business valuation. After the LOI, you can still gift. It's just that you're not going to be able to do it at that
lower level.
That lower level. It's going to be the what the business is going to essentially
That's
sell
really
for.
The crux.
Yeah.
That's the message that I really hope all our listeners
yes.
is getting. Plan early and do it with the valuation, the qualified valuation.
Yes.
Now, let's segue a little bit here
sure.
because we've touched on some of this estate planning stuff, but I really want to help identify excess capital.
Sure.
And how we do that. When we work with clients, we do a long-term cash flow plan.
Yeah.
We try to understand what it's going to cost them to live their
sure.
lifestyle.
Yeah.
So we back into it from lots of different angles as this is what I'm spending now. I want to buy a second home after
sure.
I sold my business. I want to put my grandkids through college. I have all these goals. And our team will model out what that's going to cost.
Yep.
And then we come up with what amount of money is your core capital that you need
to live
to live your life.
Exactly.
And then all that other stuff, what can we move off your balance? How much is that? So that's really what I wanted to talk about, because those are the assets that we can move outside of your estate. And these are the strategies I wanted to get in with you. So once we've identified the excess capital, what strategies should clients consider?
Yeah, that's a great synopsis. So I think ultimately we never want to let the tax tail wag the dog, especially when contemplating making irrevocable gifts or large amounts of assets earmarked to transfer off of your balance sheet, right? You first and foremost, you want to make sure that client is taken care of and that they're living the type of life that they want to, especially if they're looking to reinvest or start a new company afterwards. That can be quite important. So that cash flow plan that you mentioned helps determine, again, what they need to live on, but what excess they have to, quote, play around with. So when looking at that excess, as you mentioned, the cash flow plan determines how much. We then can take a deeper dive into what type of asset, which also helps guide the strategy that we may choose when doing planning. So for instance, if there's a high income producing asset and they determine that they either A, need that income as part of their cash flow plan, or they don't need that income and that income is better off of their balance sheet or out of their taxable estate, then there are certain strategies we can use for high income producing assets as well. So it sort of guides the best strategy to look for and to implement based on not only the excess amount, but the type of asset that they're willing to part with. So in that, we really boil down to that base legacy plan that we kind of touched on in the beginning. What do they really want to ultimately do with their assets? Is that gifts to children? Is that charity? Is that nothing? And from there, we can offer a bevy of opportunities to plan with. So, for instance, one of the most widely used strategies would be gifting to an irrevocable trust.
So, Carrie, let's assume that the founder has the core estate documents in place, right? So that's their healthcare proxy, their power of attorney, their will. They have a revocable trust.
Yep.
We've talked about how to create the cash flow, creating the cash flow plan to understand how much is enough for them,
yep,
and what they can move off their balance sheet onto their heirs.
Yep.
So that's the strategy that I want to segue into.
Perfect.
So excess wealth, estate planning strategies. We've identified excess capital. What strategies should clients consider?
So the most common structures that clients use to gift assets during life are through irrevocable trusts. The grantor, or business owner, if you will, the giver, creates an irrevocable trust, appointing a trustee who is not themselves, beneficiaries, as well as instructions on how they would like those assets within that trust administered, and will execute the document and then fund that trust or gift to that trust with those excess assets. So two types of irrevocable trusts come to mind, are typically most commonly used. The first would be a dynastic trust or a GST trust. Could have other names like a gift trust.
GST,
Generation Skipping Transfer Tax. And these trusts are set up for generations. So it would not only be for that individual's children, but children's children and future descendants down the line. So they transfer the assets to this trust. They would file that gift tax return, as mentioned. And then beyond that point, any future appreciation or growth on those underlying assets will not only be out of that grantor's taxable estate, but depending on how the trust is structured, could also remain out of the taxable estate of their children as well and future generations.
So this goes back to getting that valuation done at a very low level.
Exactly.
You can move it in.
Yes.
Off your balance sheet at a low level, and then assuming you're going to sell the business in a couple of years at a much higher valuation,
right,
you're not paying taxes on that. And hopefully and presumably your heirs are not paying tax on that appreciation as well.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So if you decide you want to transfer to an irrevocable trust $1 million of your business interests at the current valuation that the appraisal gave, then you also could receive, as mentioned, a discount for lack of control, lack of marketability. Let's assume 25%. So essentially, you are using $750,000 of your $15 million exemption to transfer at that time $1 million worth of business interests. And down the road, if the company sells for 10x, then you've now effectively transferred $10 million into this trust, only using $750,000 of your exemption. Now, important to note that income tax is still due. So while it might avoid estate tax at the beneficiary's death, there still will be income tax paid on those assets. Can't escape that.
The government always gets their bit.
Yes.
Okay. And then the other irrevocable trust that we were going to talk about is another acronym.
It's an iteration on that dynastic trust or that legacy trust, and that would be a spousal lifetime access trust.
It's called the SLAT. Yes. This is alphabet soup time here.
We love an acronym. So this is a trust where one spouse sets up a trust for the benefit of the other spouse and their children, and then funds it with a portion of their lifetime exemption amount. So that other spouse could be the beneficiary as well as the trustee. And during that spouse's lifetime, they would be able to receive trust distributions if needed for their benefit. So we typically call these Armageddon trusts, as while access to the assets are preserved through your spouse being a beneficiary, it's very tax inefficient to take assets out of this tax structure. So you're spending a portion of your $15 million lifetime exemption to get the assets in, but if you were to take them out, they would be subject to, could be subject to estate taxes upon that spouse's passing. So they should be looked at as the last bucket of assets that you draw upon. But in the event of an Armageddon, you're not going to really be concerned about estate tax savings or access to those assets.
Yeah. And sometimes people just want to know that they have that report if they need it.
Exactly.
Do we want to talk about GRATs?
Sure. So GRATS, as well as another strategy called sale to an intentionally defective grantor trust, these are trusts that are set up to really be able to transfer the appreciation alone on an asset over a government set benchmark or the 75-20 rate without using estate tax exemption or a very little amount of it. So essentially, a grantor may fund a four-year grant with $1 million worth of an asset in a month where that government set benchmark is 5%. At the first anniversary, the grantor would receive back one quarter of the total principal value because it's a four-year grant, so $250,000, plus the 75-20 rate interest at 5%. So $12,500. So $262,500 in the first year. Second year, they would receive that same amount back, as well as the third and fourth year. And after that fourth final payment of $262,500, whatever is remaining left in that trust can be transferred to beneficiaries without an estate tax or using your exemption amount.
And what are the risks around using a grant?
So the risks are relatively low. If that asset that's used to fund the grant doesn't appreciate beyond that 75-20 rate, the grantor is really out just the amount paid to the attorney to set up the grant in the first place.
Okay.
They get all the assets back. They're able to take any tax loss harvesting with a depreciated asset, and they're basically in the same spot as if they didn't do the trust in the first
place.
The
benefit is moving these assets outside the estate with little or no use of the lifetime.
Yes, which is incredibly effective when you know that your business is valued at a low amount, but has the potential to appreciate by X factor in the future.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. Thank you so much. So yeah. I know it was a bit of alphabet soup. I have one more acronym to talk about.
Sure.
Because particularly in Founderverse, many entrepreneurs have set up their businesses and have a qualified small business stock,
yes.
QSBS stock. So for those who qualify for that, what should they be thinking about as they're heading into an exit? 12 to 24 months in advance.
Yes.
Hopefully.
Yes. QSBS is quite the hot topic. So taking a step back and talking about generally how you qualify for QSBS, it only applies to C corporations.
Okay.
And that individual must have obtained their stock at an original issuance, where the company's assets were under $50 million at the time of that issuance. But due to tax laws last year put in place under the OBBBA, if you receive shares after July 4th of last year, that original issuance value must be under $75 million. The shares also must be held for at least 5 years. And clients should definitely confirm eligibility of their shares.
So it's not a given.
Legal and tax counsel. Yes, correct.
And let's talk about the benefits of QSBS. What does that allow a founder or a co-founder to
do? Pretty substantial. So they could potentially exclude up to $10 million of capital gains or 10 times the basis in the shares if it's greater, per taxpayer on a sale of those assets. As mentioned under the OBBBA, for shares acquired after July 4th of last year, there's a potential to exclude up to $15 million.
Yeah. So for those of you who are forming companies right now, this is and you're forming as a C Corp, this is a must do for you.
Yes.
But for those of you who have QSBS stock, there are some very interesting tax savings opportunities.
Correct.
$10 to $15 million, depending upon the year in which the company was founded.
That's it.
And maybe it's an AI company that was founded last year where you could sell immediately. But let's assume most of the people listening would have $10 million QSBS.
Sure.
The other planning strategy that I hear a lot about and I'd love to talk with you about is actually stacking your QSBS stock.
Yes.
So what is that and how can that really enhance its benefit?
That's a great question. So QSBS exclusions are generally limited to one per taxpayer and often one per married couple. So individuals are exploring ways to stack additional exclusions by increasing essentially the number of taxpayers. This can be done by, for instance, gifting these QSBS eligible shares to a non-grantor irrevocable trust, as and with any gifted share, the holding period transfers with the asset. So when you gift QSBS eligible shares that have been held for the requisite amount of years, that holding period and those qualifications transfer with that asset, say to a non-grantor irrevocable trust. So a non-grantor irrevocable trust is considered a separate taxpayer for income tax purposes, which means any of the income earned during the year, the taxable income that they retain, they pay their own income tax on it. So grantors may often establish a non-grantor irrevocable trust and gift QSBS eligible shares to this trust so that this trust, if structured properly, qualifies on its own for its own $10 million exclusion in addition to the grantors.
So could it go in a dynastic trust?
Depends. With very careful structuring, you would set up a trust for the benefit of essentially your children and future generations.
And could you set up a trust for each child so that they would each be a separate?
Generally, no. So the IRS has gotten wise to this and tends to look through the trusts and say if there's no, you know, if they're not substantially different or you're doing it just to receive this multiple exemption from QSBS, then no. So it has to be done with very careful drafting and by an expert attorney.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing you saying, it's got to be structured very carefully by expert attorneys.
Yes.
That you can't access those assets once they're transferred. So you really need to know your cash, what you need to support your lifestyle before you move anything.
Yes, exactly. We've had a couple conversations with very young entrepreneurs who are looking to sell their business and have QSBS eligible shares. And they're not married and they don't have kids. And they're talking about transferring, establishing six different trusts and transferring all of these assets. And then they're, well, I could just take it back the next year, can I? No, it doesn't unfortunately work like that. So you have to be able to be okay parting with those assets to some degree.
Okay, parting with assets. Let's segue to charitable giving.
Sure.
Because many of the clients that I work with, almost all the clients that my team works with are extremely philanthropic. And so if you are a founder who's going to have this big liquidity event, you're going to have a taxable event anyway. Many of my clients are thinking, okay, I'd like to set up a donor advised fund or maybe even a family foundation. So how should clients approach charitable giving around their liquidity event in terms of estate planning?
Yeah, that's a great question. With careful thought and analysis. So in addition to some changes to the QSBS laws last year, the OBBBA set in place a number of new rules surrounding charitable giving and charitable deductions on your income tax return. So most notably, they introduced a 0.5% AGI deduction floor for donations made beginning in 2026 and beyond. So essentially, this means that for every $1 million of a founder's AGI, the first $5,000 of charitable contributions are not deductible. So in the past, years that had particularly high income or they were looking at a high AGI due to a sale or liquidity event, it made sense to make large offsetting charitable contributions. But now with that floor, what that means is that the higher the AGI, the higher that non-deductible floor is going to be. Mm-hmm. So working with your CPA or tax advisor is crucial to determine if it makes sense to make these charitable deductions, contributions rather, and take deductions in that large income year, in the year of your exit, or if it makes sense to maybe hold off and take them in a following year where deductibility floor is a little bit lower.
Excellent advice. So, Carrie, does it make sense to maybe delay giving?
Sure. So working with your CPA to determine if making a single donation in a year with either high income or low income would be ideal, or even spreading out the distributions instead of making a lump sum, spreading it out, or really looking and drilling down into forecasted income that you might see coming down the road in future years, and whether it makes sense to wait or donate prior to that year. So it all just requires careful consideration and analysis based on your single...
on your situation.
Yeah.
If you are going to, if you know you're going to make a lump sum,
sure,
how would you handle that?
So there are certain strategies that you can use. If you aren't comfortable giving an outright single year large distribution to a specific charity.
To a library.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Or a wing.
Exactly. We often see clients establish what's called a donor advised fund, or a DAF. And what this is essentially an account where you would transfer your contribution to. It's held by a custodian where the assets are invested into taxable investments. You don't pay income tax on those investments as it's considered a charity. So they're able to grow while they're being invested. You receive that full deduction in the year that you contribute. So instead of writing a check piecemeal to the library each year, you're able to bunch, for instance, multiple years of donations into one. And then you can then make each year's annual contribution to that charity from the donor advised fund.
So you have
itself.
A windfall liquidity event.
Yes.
You put $100,000 into your donor advised fund. You do not need to assign a benefactor,
no,
not-for-profit,
correct,
that $100,000 that year.
Correct.
You can take your time over,
yes,
the course of a decade to decide which,
yes,
organizations you want to benefit.
That's correct.
We use this strategy often with our clients.
It's great.
And it's a great way to allocate and also build relationships with not-for-profits to determine where you really want to put the lion's share of your wealth,
exactly,
as you have more time because you've sold the baby.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
So thank you so much for talking about all these different strategies, the irrevocable trusts, the donor advice funds. Thank you so much for walking us through how important the cash flow plan is. And let's talk about implementation of these strategies.
Sure.
Honestly, how long does it take?
With any good legal question is the legal answer, it depends. So it depends on what you're looking to do, how many strategies. It depends on your estate planning attorney and their bandwidth to be able to draft documents and put them in place. But I'd say typically several months start to finish to discussing strategies, doing the requisite analysis and transferring those assets into the receiving entity.
And I would imagine that's really hard to do when you're gussing the business up for sale and you're looking,
oh, yeah,
over LOIs.
Yeah.
So again, it gets us to this. You really need to do the planning in advance.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. What's the most important thing you think our listeners should know about advanced planning?
There are no wrong answers. And a plan is as different as fingerprints on individuals. So whatever you want your legacy to look like, that's the right answer. And we can help, along with all of your other trusted professionals, to get your legacy plan in line with your legacy goals.
So build your team.
Yep.
Build your trusted,
exactly,
advisory team.
Exactly.
Early.
early. Earlier the better.
Thank you. Carrie, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it. So many takeaways. The tax, tail wagging the dog, the qualified appraisal.
Yes.
So very important.
Yes.
I can't thank you enough for your time.
Thank you.
For all of our listeners who want to learn more about you, how do they learn more about you?
Through you.
Oh, a handoff. Thank you.
We also have searching advanced planning. We have a website that we have some of our publications on, and you can learn a little bit more about UBS's advanced planning group. You just plug in UBS advanced planning group and it'll get you right there.
Fantastic. Thank you, Carrie.
Thank you.
Thank you again, all your listeners. If there's an advanced planning question you have that I can help with and I can have Carrie help us with, please feel free to reach out. Onward. That's it for today's episode of F3, Female Forward Finance. If you found this conversation valuable, be sure to subscribe, leave a review, and more importantly, share it with another woman who could benefit. If you'd like to stay updated with insights, resources, and exclusive content, join my mailing list by emailing me at jill.lloyd@ubs.com. Until next time, keep building, keep growing, and let's make those financial dreams a reality. Onward.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.
This podcast was edited by Resonate Recordings.